Hey folks, welcome to today's Talky Bit. It's good to be with you. Let's take a few moments to breathe together. If this is a practice that you share with us as a community, you want to make some time for it. I'm not going to give it any particular focal point this morning, just invite us to some moments of stillness. I was reminded again by a very thoughtful friend this past week that being still is not something that we all do well or naturally. That's one of the reasons why any meditation practice sort of historically often includes meditation that is in motion, walking meditation, that kind of thing. Being still and focusing on breath, that expression of mindfulness or meditation is not for every body and every brain. And so I want to acknowledge that while I also invite us to that particular kind of practice in our setting. So if that's your jam, and also if you have circumstances that support that and you're able to do it, I'd invite you to just engage this morning with three rounds of in through your nose till you're filled right up. Cradle your breath. Be grateful for life and breath and the coming of spring or whatever the bright spot is in your world today. And then pursed lip exhale. So there's some resistance, like you were blowing out a candle. Empty yourself right out, count of eight, often does that for people, and then we'll repeat that twice more, and then we will go on from there. Okay? Let's breathe together. Peace, everybody. Thank you. I grew up around the Jesus stories, and they remain through all the different sort of permutations and changes and evolutions of what I believe. They remain a deep and abiding benchmark for the intersection of ancient wisdom and deep love and my lived experience. Their ancientness as a feature has come to mean different things to me over the years, different sort of iterations of my own belief. I sometimes find myself these days wishing that I could drag that first century rabbi into 2022 and I could hand him a few essays about neuroscience to read. And then sit down and chat and see how that information in those essays might impact or even alter some of his most famous musings about how to live the best life possible. By which I do not mean, because I do not believe Jesus meant the most, necessarily the most self-fulfilling life possible. Had somebody say to me once, they were from the Deep South, and they had that accent that goes with growing up in the Deep South, and they said, you know, all the yous in Jesus stories are y'alls, and I don't say the accent to make anything humorous or derogatory of it, but rather because the importance of that y'all in what they were saying, what the message was, that any time these ancient stories talk about you, they're talking about us. They're talking about something communal. They're talking about a people, not an individual. And so when Jesus talks about the best life possible, or ideas that point toward that, the stories should always be understood in a couple of important frames. One is they're always pointing toward interdependence as wellness, as wholeness, as the best life possible. And interdependence, of course, is complex and involves things like self-sacrifice, not just self-realization, and so on. So that's one of the important sort of surrounding complexities for any of the stories. Another one is that they were often, and especially the text I'm about to reference, which is from a collection of sayings that are, as a collection, offered to us in the environment of Jesus talking to a group of people. That group of people, historically speaking, would have largely been comprised, aside from some critics who were kind of watching from the wings, largely being comprised of a group of people who were living under a military occupation on land that was theirs, that they had nurtured and built up and put in the gardens and built the homes and done the work of making their place, but had it taken from them by a neighboring usurper that had a bigger, better equipped army. A familiar story, right? Again, it gives some context to all of these stories that does change their tone and give them a different, I find, more challenging timbre. Anyway, in particular, and this intersection of sort of, you know, neuroscience and like contemporary knowledge and ancient wisdom, in particular, that intersection at this moment in time brought to mind this text, which is from the collections in Matthew, which has Jesus saying, "Don't be anxious for tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself." Rather fascinating personification of tomorrow. "Each day's own evil is sufficient." That sounds like generally pretty sound advice to me. Worrying, as that same rabbi observes a few verses earlier in that same collection, can't even add an hour to our lives. An hour. In fact, both research and practical lived experience make it plain that worrying is much more likely to take hours off our lives, which in a lovely sort of poetic turn makes worrying the ultimate waste of the time we have, doesn't it? Of this moment that we're in. Not only does it waste it, it reduces it. But saying, "Don't worry, it's a waste of time," to someone that's inclined to worry, or to maybe most of us these days as denizens of a culture that soaks us in reasons to worry 24/7, might be a little bit like expecting the warning on a cigarette package that these things will kill you to actually change the behavior of a lifelong smoker. You know, it might make us go, "How about that?" while we light up, but not much more than that. Because it's not quite that simple, is it? There are some good reasons why it's not quite that simple, and that's what makes me say that I think it would be interesting to have that post-article chat with Jesus. Now, that's impossible in historic or time-bound terms, but it does seem to me that an ongoing conversation between ancient wisdom and what we're learning along the way is always our jobs as humans. This is part of what we are here to do. And I would say that is true regardless of the traditions we grew up in or that we find ourselves drawn to. And I think if we're drawn to any substantial enduring tradition, we're going to find that conversation is there and that it's ongoing. We might not hear it from preacher X on Sunday morning, who might talk about those ancient traditions as though they were contemporary stories and ignore the dialogue in between. But if we examine the history of whatever it is that we're drawn to, we're going to find that this dialogue between the ancient and the historic and then the contemporary is ongoing. It's always there in those collections. And so it's consciously in that spirit that I've found myself exploring this past week. Partly, for me, that was because of a conversation I had with someone earlier in the week about what it feels like to live in a world where it's hard to know who to trust. And we were talking in particular in that conversation about media sources, about the news, if you will. And I told this person about a personal experience of mine where for the first time I encountered in an incontrovertible way the fact that us humans, can only bear witness in a helpful way to what we've actually experienced, to what we have in fact witnessed. And that of necessity means that what we think we know is pretty limited. And I'm not going to tell that story today. But I can tell you that it rocked my 20-something world to realize that this big category of, you know, established Western media was not an adequate catchment for that must be exactly what happened and what those happenings mean, that it was a particular lens. I'm not talking here about conspiracy theories or ideas that are pretty easy to test. I had a conversation, it was a rich week for conversations, but it's true. I had a conversation this past week with someone who has family members who believe that COVID vaccines will turn us all into lizards. I'm not joking. This is not tongue-in-cheek. This is a difficult situation for the person in question. That is what I mean by a testable belief. Either all of us vaccinated folks will turn into lizards or we won't. And that's the test of that belief. I'm not talking about that. I am talking about the kinds of information that we all have access to that are offered to us as fit for public consumption and trust, and that we use to form our stories, that we use, that we reference, that we draw upon to make meaning of the world. Philippa Perry has a book called how to stay sane, which feels uniquely timely, I'm not sure, but certainly kind of got my attention as a title. She offers this take on those ideas in that book, How to Stay Sane. She writes, "Our stories give shape to our inchoate, desperate, fleeting impressions of everyday life. These things that just come at us and they don't necessarily make sense, and they come from such a variety of perspectives, and they happen so fast and so briefly that it's hard to know what to make of them, but we need to, that's what we're working with when we try to make meaning. So our stories give shape to those kinds of experiences," she says. She goes on to write, "Stories bring together the past and the future into the present to provide us with structures for working towards our goals. They give us a sense of identity, and more importantly, serve to integrate the feelings of our right brain with the language of the left." More importantly to her, because she's writing from that perspective about how our brains function. She goes on, "We are primed to use stories. Part of our survival as a species depended upon listening to the stories of our tribal elders as they shared parables and passed down their experience and the wisdom of those who went before." That's the intersection of the wisdom and the contemporary that I was talking about, right? That integration of those things. "As we get older, it is our short-term memory that fades rather than our long-term memory. Perhaps we have evolved like this so that we're able to tell the younger generation about the stories and experiences that have formed us, which may be important to subsequent generations if they are to thrive. I worry, though, about what might happen to our minds if most of the stories we hear are about greed, war, and atrocity." Now, when we take that last sentence, that concern about what might happen to our minds if most of the stories we hear are about greed, war, and atrocity, we might readily think of the current news cycle, and in particular of its emphasis on the latter two, at the moment, war and atrocity. Wars and rumors of wars, to reference an ancient phrase, are the stuff of the everyday. There is nothing new about that. I don't mean to diminish the importance of being aware of those sorts of events in any way by saying that. I do mean to bring some sense of empathy to the concern that Perry voices when she muses about what might happen to our minds if these are mostly the stories we hear. She also, of course, talks about stories of greed. Stories of greed feels like a more complicated category to me, and I think that's about proximity. On this continent, where we currently live in relative peace, we react to stories of war and atrocity. We react very strongly in some cases. And we do that for lots of reasons, one of which is the discernible fact that these experiences are not our normal. I'm not going to explore this morning, but another reason is because of our, I think, built-in concern that they are not so extraordinary in the world, that they could not be something we experience, that they might not be a present danger to us, but they're not an unimaginable danger. Relative to all of that, we seem pretty inured, pretty numb to stories about greed. In fact, in many ways, we've normalized those stories. We even turn to them as narratives about motivation or about success. And perhaps we've become comfortable answering the question, how much is enough, with just a little bit more. The problem is that stories about how getting more is the way to a better life can malform our minds just as much as a constant diet of stories about war and atrocity. But really, what's the alternative? We're surrounded. And not only that, the stories our culture often tells about the ideal to imitate, and we primarily learn as a species by imitation, those stories often celebrate people whose core belief about a good life involves crushing others in order to reach your goal. And we might dress it up with, we might dress it up with nicer words like competition, but when it gets ugly, we say things like, that's just the cost of doing business, and then we carry on. So what to do? Well, on one, and I would say a perhaps not very satisfying level, this is pretty simple. As artist Austin Kleon wisely says, you are a mashup of what you let into your life. So if we don't want to view our lives through the lenses of greed, war, and atrocity, one thing we can do is dial down the volume of the stories about that in our lives, dial down the frequency, dial down, as We were reminded already today, dial down the doom scrolling, you know? That's a choice. Perry cites research that demonstrates that people who watch television for more than 4 hours a day see themselves as far more likely to be the victim of a violent incident in the coming week than their peers who watch less than 2 hours a day. She doesn't mention or reference any research in that particular part of the book about what it does to our brains if we spend many hours a day doom scrolling the internet, but it's not a reach to surmise that the outcomes would be, you know, consistent with this. I remember reading about a trend in architecture, particularly in landscape design, that works with this aspect of how our brains function. And this particular article cited was about the placement and shape of sidewalks on a new development on a university campus. And instead of having the designer draw lines on a plan and then having the construction crews put the sidewalks there, the landscape architects left the grounds unpaved for a year after the facility opened, and they watched where people walked and where their walking actually formed paths by those choices, repeated choices, and then they put the sidewalks there. Our brains have what are often called neural pathways. Parts of the brain where the neurons necessary to our functioning fire up to take care of whatever task it is that they congregate around and facilitate. Those pathways are formed, among other things, by use. And they get stronger when they get exercised. They're like a muscle in that regard. Where we walk, neurologically speaking, is where the paths form. Now, this is an essential aspect of how we come to believe what we believe. And when we gather in this community, our stated reason for gathering, for existing, is exploring what we believe. That's why I often reference these kind of things, because they are an integral part of how that works. The stories that we hear, the meanings that we find, all have a deep impact on things like how much hope we're able to bring to bear on our daily lives. And we might think that this line of exploration is in danger of becoming, you know, Pollyanna-ish, sort of the all good, everything's good sort of vulnerability, a kind of path that could lead to blind optimism or to toxic positivity, the refusal to be present to anything that is not positive. And I expect if we follow it without being critical or aware of that vulnerability, that could happen. I think that's a real, a legitimate cautionary note. With that in mind, though, I think it's important to not ignore some of what we know about how our brains are set up so that when we come to believe what we believe isn't working at odds with how we function neurologically. Because to function in a space where what we believe or what we're required to believe or told we should believe is at odds with how our brains come to believe things, that's just a whole nother kind of being asked to leave our brains at the door when it comes to belief. Tali Chereau, in her book called The Science of Optimism, Why We're Hardwired for Hope, summarizes her own research and other studies in this realm to make the argument that our brains have what she calls an adaptive optimism bias. You couldn't prove that by the general stance adopted by most news stories now, could you? Good news doesn't sell well, and there's always plenty of not so good news to access to ratchet up the ratings. I think that's a discernibly visible reason why we're often surrounded in media by bad news. To reference that saying of Jesus, every day's evil is sufficient. We might joke about a slow news day when we hear a positive story in the news. That's a little telling, isn't it? It's like you didn't have anything substantial to report, so you told us something that was good. That's pretty messed up. Anyway, it's there. Chereau, in this book, The Science of Optimism, suggests that we're actually wired to be, quote, more optimistic than realistic. interesting. And that bias is about survival. She writes this, optimism starts with what may be the most extraordinary of human talents, mental time travel. That is, the ability to move back and forth through time and space in one's mind, to think positively about our prospects. It helps to be able to imagine ourselves in the future. Although most of us take this ability for granted, our capacity to envision a different time and place is critical for our survival. It allows us to plan ahead, to save food and resources for times of scarcity, and to endure hard work in anticipation of a future reward. Okay. That kind of makes sense, right? If we can't imagine a future, it's hard to plan for one. No imagined rainy days, no savings for such a rainy day. Now, Sherrill goes on to remind us that there's another side to this remarkable human ability of mental time travel. And in some ways, to put it into the idiom I just mentioned, she's talking about what happens when we imagine the future, and it's all we're imagining is rainy days. What do we do then? She says it this way. While mental time travel has clear survival advantages, conscious foresight comes to us as humans at an enormous price. The understanding that somewhere in the future, death awaits. This knowledge that old age, sickness, decline of mental power, and oblivion are somewhere around the corner can be devastating. It isn't always devastating, of course. There are ways to face that reality of our human experience that are actually quite hopeful, but it's often devastating. Now, so can a steady diet of being reminded of this, of retreading this ground over and over until the best worn neural pathways are the ones that lead to whatever negative perspective devastates us. When we live and operate in a society, in a culture that is obsessed with youth, that is obsessed with the hallmarks of being young, the energy, the vitality, the appearance of being young, the range of options available to the young versus the range of options perceived as being available to those not so young, for instance. When we live on a steady diet of that, what we're doing is wearing in a certain set of neural pathways. Perry again, she puts it this way. Be careful which stories you expose yourself to. The meanings you find and the stories you hear will have an impact on how optimistic you are. It's how we evolved. If you do not know how to draw positive meaning from what happens in life, the neural pathways you need to appreciate good news will never fire up. In other words, if we don't walk that way often enough, when we need that path, it's going to be a hard one to find or make use of because it's going to be, metaphorically speaking, rough and overgrown. I know these are not simple ideas. So let me just acknowledge that again. Let's go back to that Jesus saying for a moment. There are really two very different ways to read it. One is essentially pessimistic. The other is more optimistic. The pessimistic reading of that saying suggests that Jesus is saying that the evil of each individual day is so great and so overbearing that it's hard enough to get through one day, much less to worry about the ones that are coming. It's a reading that suggests that imagining a better future is the work of fools, of the delusional, or of those that can't handle, of those that can handle making meaning out of constant rumination on an inevitable grim ending. That somehow there's this subcategory of humans that have a little something extra where they can look at the inevitable grimness and still see a bright spot, but that they are the exception. The more optimistic view of that same saying is to read it as essentially a rephrasing of the ancient idea of carpe diem. Live each day to its fullest, because one never knows what will happen tomorrow. Again, our cultural tendencies make this a difficult idea to even entertain, perhaps. We have enjoyed in our culture in this last couple of hundred years a relatively microscopic blip on the human history. Time-wise, we have enjoyed a great deal of agency and positive experience and well-resourced life. The illusion that we can control tomorrow has a lot of reinforcement under those circumstances. We make a plan, we get up the next morning, we're able to execute the plan. Tomorrow behaved a lot like we thought it would. Repeat that enough times, guess which pathway gets worn in our brain? The pathway that says you can control the future. You can actually, in ways that are meaningful, you can predict it, you can manage it. That does make it more difficult, to sort of look at this from the other angle, to have an established pathway for a thing like uncertainty. So one of the things I love about the table, honestly, is that we are constantly in the terrain of considering the implications of uncertainty. And that means we're walking down that path. We are practicing considering that and its implications. And that equips us for experiences that remind us that life is, in fact, not quite that much under our control. What to do with this? Well-known writer, filmmaker, philosopher, teacher, political activist, Susan Sontag, famously wrote in her journal, quote, "If I expect as little as possible, I won't get hurt." Chereau, the author of that book about optimism that I was citing, offers this perspective on that approach. She says, "The problem with pessimistic expectations, such as those of the clinically depressed, is that they have the power to alter the future. Negative expectations shape outcomes in a negative way." Not everyone agrees with this assertion. Some people believe that the secret to happiness is low expectations. If we don't expect greatness or find love or maintain health or achieve success, we will never be disappointed. If we started out not expecting those things, is what she's saying. If we're never disappointed when things don't work out and we're pleasantly surprised when things go well, we will be happy. It's a good theory, but it's wrong. Research shows that whatever the outcome, whether we succeed or we fail, people with high expectations tend to feel better. At the end of the day, how we feel when we get dumped or win an award depends mostly on how we interpret the event. And I would affirm that, that our lived experience reflects the perspective on the events more than the content of the events themselves. That's why under the same circumstances, one person will be talking about what they hope for and the other person will find that impossible to do and sort of, you know, in between, right? And just to build on that quote a little bit, it's not just how we feel when we get dumped or when we win an award, but how we feel about things like wars and rumors of wars, about living in a culture obsessed with more, 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 or whatever it is that reminds us that life is not all sunshine and roses. As is often the case with trying to illustrate a complex idea with contrasts, never mind doing it in 30 minutes or so, like in a talky bit, everything I've been saying here leaves a lot out. So, but let's just say that's always a given, shall we? I'll say it again another time, of course, but for now, let's just acknowledge that. This leaves a lot out. And that's one of the reasons why exploring what we believe in the context of a community is so important. As a species, we are herd animals, we are hive animals, we're anthill animals, whatever, you know, picture you want to use. Point being, we do better work together than we do alone. That our best stuff is stuff that we come up with together, where many people are contributing from many different perspectives. Doing our own work is important. I would say it's even essential. That's what we bring to the collective. So is talking with one another about what we're thinking about and exploring, having the conversations. Lots of us, this is a tangent, so let's just name it what it is. Lots of us have grown up in religious environments where we were taught not to do this. We were taught that what you do when you talk about what you believe is you affirm what you were told you should believe. You affirm what you were taught is right belief. The party line, essentially. That's what you say when you talk about what you believe. And if somebody says something different than that, if you're a well-trained believer, you have an answer to that objection. You have a way to either shut it down or call it into question, or if you've been trained in a gentler, kindler version of that same frame of belief, you have a way to thoughtfully ask the question that reveals it as a fallacy, this other person's belief. But either way, the point is to get them over to where you are and get them saying the right things, not talking about those wrong and dangerous things. Lots of us grew up in environments like that, religious environments like that. And the fear of saying the thing that is not what we sense is the collective is on about, whooey, that is a deep and powerful and abiding human experience. It can be so hard to believe something different than that, that if we find ourselves believing something that isn't normative in the setting we're in, we feel as though our only option is to leave that setting, to just leave a community, leave a relationship. That is not a fully orbed belief. It is deeply informed by a perspective that says the only way toward hope and wholeness is right belief, and that right belief is a vertically transmitted thing, not something that we form together. As you may have guessed in the last few moments, I believe something different than that, And one of the reasons that I think the table is a special place is because of our ongoing efforts to form a community where that is not the prevailing norm, but where it's rather a concerted and conscious attempt to work together to explore what we believe and to make a safe space to do that. That's not an uncomplicated idea, and sometimes it does, and sometimes it will fail. Also important to know. I'm not thinking of anything in particular in the moment when I say that. All right, let me bring this home a little bit if I can with the musings of another wise person about this complicated intersection of choosing our inputs so that we can form stories that are neither blind to reality nor so deeply buried in pessimism that we can't appreciate the light that we are also surrounded by. Again, a little tangent before I get to that quote. Hanging around with little people can be remarkably revealing in this regard. Not always the case, of course, as parents with young kids sometimes like to remind me, a parent who does not have little kids at this point in my life. We did raise four of those, so I'm not, you know, unaware of the challenges of having little people, but it's not my 24/7 reality right now. It can be exhausting. And so, you know, if you've got a little person and they're making you pull your hair out right now, and Tim, you know, who's old enough to have grandkids, is saying, aren't the little people bright spots in the world and you're not feeling it? Just know that I hear you. And they are bright spots in the world. Partly because when their world is in good repair, when they are loved and supported, they are able to enact hope unconsciously in ways that those of us who are musing about the complexities and facing consciously the challenges of being hopeful people in a world filled with challenging things, they remind us that this can happen. But it takes being loved and being supported and being nurtured. We need one another in order to be able to wear in the neural pathways that lead to hope and to optimism without being in denial of things like evil and atrocity and difficulties, right? All right, so the quote, Montaigne. 500 years ago, so, you know, almost contemporary wisdom compared to that Jesus quote. But anyway, 500 years ago, this is part of Montaigne's larger musings about mortality, about death, end of human life. And in particular, in this case, I wanted to reference our ability to imagine the future and how, even though that brings us face to face with our own mortality, how we might choose to respond to that in ways that move us toward a more hopeful view of the future rather than, on balance, a more pessimistic one. Here's the quote. Wherever your life ends, it is all there. There's more to the quote, so stay with me. If I just left it there, my goodness, does that ever feel like a sort of a Zen bumper sticker or something? Wherever you are, there you are, you know, kind of like that. Wherever your life ends, it is all there. The utility of living consists not in the length of days, but in the use of time. A person may have lived long and yet lived but a little. Make use of time while it is present with you. It depends upon your will and not upon the number of days to have a sufficient length of life. He's just saying there's a different way to measure whether you had enough days. And the lens he's using is the lens of choice. What are we doing with the time we have? In other words, a perspective that is much closer to the optimistic reading of that Jesus saying than to the pessimistic reading of that saying. We don't know what tomorrow will bring, so we would be wise to make use of the time while we have it. What we do with this moment is what will wear in the path of optimism, that path that helps us understand even the most dire events in ways that are not devoid of hope, but that continue to see the possibility of a brighter tomorrow, of a future in which we are able to continue to make the most of the days that we have. And that, my friends, can fortify our will, to reference Montaigne, as we work to tilt the mashup of what we let into our lives more toward the light than the dark. And yes, that does require opting out on some of the perspectives we are surrounded by, or opting in less often, because those perspectives often trade on the power of fear. Not just reporting information, but reporting it with a certain perspective that touches the fear pathway in us, because that's a powerful pathway, and it keeps us coming back to that trough, to that source. So it's a conscious choice, for sure. But we can fortify our will. We can tilt the mashup of what we let into our lives more toward the light than toward the dark. And that's one of the ways that we can build resiliency. We can build hope. We can wear in the neural pathways, the thought pathways of our thoughts that remind us that all is not lost in this moment. And this is the moment we have. Lean in. Peace to you all. It's been good to be with you. I'm glad we get to gather like this. I look forward to being together again soon.